Good evening, ladies. I just kind of want to ask y'all a couple of questions. How many of you, here we are, next to the last week of John, you've just gone over your last lesson. How many of you feel like we just started just a couple of weeks ago? How many of you feel like we've spent an eternity in John? I know you wouldn't raise your hand on that, but you're thinking it. You're thinking it. Sometimes I feel one way and sometimes the other. I kind of think both are true. You know, in a way I'm ready to be finished with John, but in another way I feel like we've just begun and I can't believe we're at the end here. Now, at this final lesson, we looked at the snapshot of Jesus as the King. And I think our understanding of this particular picture is limited because people here really have no experience or concept of kings or kingdoms. So it sort of racked my brain to think of any kind of parallel that we might understand. And the only one I could come up with was being a homeowner. You're sort of the king of your home. You're the queen of your home, right? It's your home. You lay down the rules and you have the power to enforce those rules. You can pretty much do anything you want to there. You can tear down walls or you can paint the whole thing purple if that's what you want to do, because you are in control of that particular kingdom. If someone wants to come into your kingdom, you determine if they come in and you let them know what they are allowed to do in your home. And I think the reason I started thinking about this was because I have a young woman, who cleans my house every 2 weeks. She's done that ever since I went to work full time. She's a blessing to me. I don't know what I would do without her. But she doesn't like where I have put certain things, and she moves them. And you know those little rocks? If you were with us for Joshua, we gave everybody a little rock. Well, mine is on the edge of my bathtub, and she doesn't like it there. Every time she comes, she moves it somewhere else. She moves my sugar bowl. She moves my contact lens holder. And if I'm missing something, or my husband is, we just go, I wonder where Tori put it. It's got to be here somewhere. Now, there's something wrong there, because it's my house, and I should be able to determine what happens there and where things are put, right? Well, so it is with Jesus' kingdom. When we are part of his kingdom, we should bow the knee because he has control of his realm. And we should submit to what he wants done in his kingdom. Now, this is our last snapshot in the book of John, as you know. And I want us to review for just a minute. As we saw, there are two basic sections of John. The first 12 chapters we have referred to as the book of signs, because it's through this part of the book where we see the majority of the signs that Jesus performed, proving that he was indeed the king. In that section, we saw Jesus re-engineer genetics and turn water into wine. We saw how he healed long distance without even having a cell phone. We saw how he restored a man's legs whose muscles would have been totally atrophied. We watched him as he multiplied the molecules involved in food, as he spoke a violent storm to an end, as he healed a man born blind from birth, and as he returned life to his friend who had been dead for 3 days. All that was in the book of the signs. Then in John, toward the end of John 12 into John 13, John's narrative turns. Instead of focusing on the signs, it begins to focus on the hour. And so we referred to this section as the book of the hour. We had the book of the signs and then the book of the hour. Three times, though, in the first section of the book, Jesus referred to his hour and he said, "My hour has not yet come." And then finally in John 12, it turns and he says, "My hour has now come." So let's look at that in John 12, 23 to 33, where Jesus announced that his hour had finally come. He made it clear that he would not be harmed. In the first part of the book, he made it clear he would not be harmed until his hour actually came. So in John 12, beginning in verse 23, he says, Jesus replied, "The time has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the solemn truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains by itself alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. The one who loves his life destroys it, and the one who hates his life in this world guards it for eternal life. If anyone wants to serve me, he must follow me, and where I am, my servant will be too. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Now my soul is greatly distressed. And what should I say? Father, deliver me from this hour? No, but for this very reason I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven. "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd that stood there and heard the voice said that it had thundered. Others said that an angel had spoken. Jesus said, "This voice has not come for my benefit, but for yours. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be driven out. And I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." Now he said this to indicate clearly what kind of death he was going to die. So we see that he revealed that the hour would be the time when he would be lifted up from the earth in crucifixion and die. It would be the hour when Satan would be defeated, and it would be the hour when Jesus and God would be glorified. And we see that the hour began at this point when events began to be set in motion that would culminate in Jesus' death and resurrection. The hour would prove once for all that he not only was the Jewish Messiah, but he was truly King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that he was God come to earth to die for us. And he would be exalted as the true king through these events. Now, what John makes clear here about Jesus was not at all clear to the Jewish leaders. They weren't sure about this. And part of the reason was because Jesus was a king who lived incognito for many years. Although he was the king of the universe, he appeared to be an ordinary man. So he lived incognito in his own kingdom, although he was the king. If we go back to the prologue in John 1:10-11, it says, "He was in the world, and the world was created by him, but the world did not recognize him. He came to what was his own, but his own people did not receive him." Throughout Jesus' ministry, the Jewish leaders opposed him at every turn. And the people were unsure of him. In a sense, he began to be on trial from the very beginning of his ministry. As people opposed him, as they questioned him, he was tried in every place he went, for every word he said, for every sign that he performed. Because through those signs and through those words, they recognized that he was claiming to be God himself. They pointed that to the fact that he was more than a man. So he was tried for his claims. And those trials began in unofficial ways and eventually culminated in actual trials. Now, particularly, I want you to turn to John 5 because we really see how he's on trial here, even though it's not an official trial. And here, Jesus talks about witnesses to him and testimony for him, which would be necessary if he were on trial. And we know that the Jews had a law that there had to be at least two witnesses for someone to be found guilty. So we want to begin in John 5:31. "If I testify about myself, my testimony is not true. There is another who testifies about me, and I know the testimony he testifies about me is true. You have sent to John, and he has testified to the truth. I do not accept human testimony, but I say this so you may be saved. He was a lamp that was burning and shining, and you wanted to rejoice greatly for a short time in his light." So the first witness that he calls is John the Baptist, and he says, "He testified of me." And then let's go on in verse 36. "But I have a testimony greater than that from John, for the deeds that the Father has assigned me to complete, the deeds I am now doing testify about me that the Father has sent me. And the Father who has sent me has himself testified about me. You people have never heard his voice nor seen his form at any time. Nor do you have his word residing in you because you do not believe the one whom he sent. You study the scriptures thoroughly because you think in them you possess eternal life. And it is these same scriptures that testify about me, but you are not willing to come to me so that you may have life. He says, my second witness is the signs that I've been performing. They witness and testify of who I am. And the third witness is the Father himself, who has spoken through his word, and yet they refuse to believe. Skip down to verse 45. He says, do not suppose that I will accuse you before the Father. The one who accuses you is Moses, in whom you have placed your hope. If you believed Moses, you would believe me, because he wrote about me. But if you do not believe what Moses wrote, how will you believe my words? Although the people were essentially putting Jesus on trial, the witnesses proved that it was the accusers who were guilty because they refused to believe the testimony about Jesus. They were the ones guilty, not Jesus. But eventually the Jewish leaders found a way to officially try him and to condemn him for his claims, not only to be the king of the Jews, but to be God himself. John records two trials before Jesus' execution, one before Annas and one before Pilate. If we read the other Gospels, we would see there was actually a third trial before the Sanhedrin, where the high priest Caiaphas was. But we're going to focus on these two trials. And it's interesting because John's description of both the arrest and the trials really gives us a paradox, because we see those who oppose Jesus acting of their own accord, but we also see that Jesus was in control. He directed everything. He, more than any other gospel writer, John lets us see that Jesus controlled his own destiny. He was not merely a victim. He chose to die. And Jesus gave his followers a glimpse of this. If you remember back in John 10, when we read about the good shepherd, he says in verse 11, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And then down in verses 14 through 18, he says, I am the good shepherd. I know my own and my own know me, just as the Father knows me and I know my Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that do not come from this sheepfold. I must bring them too, and they will listen to my voice, so that there will be one flock and one shepherd. This is why the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it back again. No one takes it away from me, but I lay it down of my own free will. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it back again. This commandment I received from my Father. Jesus directed his own destiny not only in his death, but also in his resurrection. He took his life back up again. And so through John's eyes, we see this, and we see him manage even his own arrest. So I want us to look at his arrest in John 18 to see how he was in control of this time. Beginning in verse 1. When he had said these things, Jesus went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley. There was an orchard there, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, the one who betrayed him, knew the place too, because Jesus had met there many times with his disciples. So Judas obtained a squad of soldiers and some officers of the chief priests and Pharisees. They came to the orchard with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, because he knew everything that was going to happen to him, came and asked them, "Who are you looking for?" They replied, "Jesus the Nazarene." He told them, "I am he." Now Judas, the one who betrayed him, was standing there with them. So when Jesus said to them, "I am he," they retreated and fell to the ground. Then Jesus asked them again, "Who are you looking for?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus replied, "I told you that I am he. If you are looking for me, let these men go." He said this to fulfill the word he had spoken, "I have not lost a single one of those whom you have given me." Jesus was in control of his own arrest, and we really see that here. The other Gospels emphasize Judas' betrayal of him with a kiss. But John points out that Jesus actually walked toward the soldiers as they came. He confronted them. He met his accusers. He identified himself to them, and if you remember from our previous study, he used the words ego eimi, the Greek word saying, "I am. And we know from our study this can mean the name of God, or it can just mean I am Kay Daigle or whatever. It would be used both ways. So scholars are debate whether here he was actually using the divine name of God or not. But we see that what happened was when he said, I am, the soldiers fell back and even fell down to the ground. And so one obvious possibility here is that when Jesus used the divine name for himself, the power of God and his name pushed the soldiers back and they fell on the ground. Jesus had the power not to be arrested if that's what he had chosen to do. And that's what John points out for us as we see what happened, which the soldiers would have never even understood. I'm sure they were like, why in the world did this happen to us? But that is the great power of God. Jesus could have stopped his arrest at any time. But although he was in control, we do need to understand Judas was still guilty. John doesn't record the kiss, but every gospel writer records different details. And John's purpose here was to share, was really to stress that Jesus was the king and he was in control of this situation. Whether anybody recognized him as the king or not, he was in control of the situation. How else did Jesus direct the situation? Well, in his trials before Annas and Pilate, he, in the sense, led the conversation. He answered only the questions he wanted to answer, and he led them to other places than even their questions would have taken them, because he had things that he wanted to get across to these men. John's account of the trial before Annas in John 18, verses 19 to 23, which we're not going to read, but it reveals that Jesus wanted to be sure they knew there was no evidence against him. And he pointed that out to them because he, as their king, wanted to say, you are condemning an innocent man and you know it. There is no evidence against me. And then as morning came, Annas sent him on to Pilate, who was the ruler of Judea at the time, the Roman ruler. And Jesus had a conversation then with Pilate. And we do want to look at this one in John 18, 33 to 37. And I want you to really think about it. Listen carefully to his account and see how Jesus turned the conversation the way he wanted it to go. So Pilate went back into the governor's residence, summoned Jesus and asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus replied, are you saying this on your own initiative or have others told you about me? Pilate answered, I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own people and your chief priests handed you over to me. What have you done? And notice, Jesus never really answers that question at all. He says, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my servants would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish authorities. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here. Then Pilate said, so you're a king? Jesus replied, you say that I'm a king. For this reason I was born, and for this reason I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said, what is truth? Now, this is only the first conversation with Pilate. Drop down to chapter 19, verse 7, and we'll read the second one. The Jewish leaders replied, we have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he claimed to be the Son of God. When Pilate heard what they said, he was more afraid than ever. And he went back into the governor's residence and said to Jesus, where do you come from? But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said, do you refuse to speak to me? Don't you know I have the authority to release you and to crucify you? Jesus replied, you would have no authority over me at all unless it was given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of greater sin. Jesus made sure that Pilate heard the truth before he executed him, that he was the true king, and Pilate was only able to kill him because Jesus allowed it. Pilate was not in control. Jesus was. Now, as part of Jesus' punishment, Pilate had him flogged, as you read in your lesson. However, even in that flogging, Jesus was exalted because the soldiers unwittingly gave him a coronation. They had no idea what they were doing, but they coronated Jesus when they flogged him. There's a somewhat hidden literary structure in the Bible called a chiasm, which I had never even heard of until I went to seminary, because you don't just see it on the face of it. But apparently it's very common in Hebrew literature. When they want to emphasize something, they build it into a structure called a chiasm. And we have one here in this section of the book. And what a chiasm does, it takes parallel ideas and it builds them so that you can see what the main point was. And we put it at the bottom of your handout and on our screen. And these are the things that a chiasm moves to a central point and then back. Each letter, the A parallels the A at the bottom, the B parallels the B, and so on. So we see here, Jesus flogged, which is in 19:1, parallels Jesus was struck in 19:3. Jesus was crowned in 19:2, parallels him being hailed as king in 19:3. And the center thought is that he was arrayed in a royal robe in 19:2. By inserting this chiasm here, John helps us see that the soldiers unwittingly coronated him by crowning him and arraying him in a royal robe. This is an emphasis of this whole section of the book, which the chiasm points out. So although we might not have been aware of how significant that was, and the soldiers certainly had no idea what they were doing, unwittingly they gave Jesus a crown and a robe and hailed him as king. The other thing we see here is that in order to dissuade people from doing criminal acts, when the Romans crucified someone, they would write the charges against them on a sign and attach it to the cross, which is what they did in Jesus' case. John 19:9 tells us that the sign on his cross said, "Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews," and it was written in three languages. It was written in Roman, which was the political language of the day. It was written in Aramaic, which was the Jewish language of the day. And it was written in Greek, which was the international language of the day. But if you remember, the Jews were incensed that Pilate wrote it that way. Jesus, the Nazarene, King of the Jews. They wanted it to say, "This man said, I'm the King of the Jews." One commentator described this. I really loved it. He was talking about the wording of the charge, and he said it was Pilate's last act of revenge in this case, but it serves God's ends. The Lord Jesus is indeed the King of the Jews. The cross is the means of his exaltation and the very manner of his glorification. Jesus is king not only of the Jews, but of all the world. And it's interesting that it was written in the languages of the world at that time. We also see that he even received a king's burial. John 19:38-41 tells us that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus after he had been crucified. And they buried it in a new tomb where no one had previously been buried before. They wrapped his body with spices weighing 75 pounds. Now think of that, 75 pounds of spices. And one scholar says this about that: 500 servants bearing spices participated in the funeral procession of Herod the Great. The implication in the present narrative is that two wealthy men, being Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, used their servants to carry the spices, help take Jesus' body down from the cross, and then prepare him for burial. Jesus was given a burial befitting a king. The amount of spices he was given would have been reserved for the very wealthy or the royal who had died. His tomb was unused, which would be suitable for a king's tomb. But you know, the story doesn't end when the king was buried, because the king rose again. He came out of that grave where they buried him. And it's interesting to consider the fact that if there had been more than one body there, the Jews would have claimed, no, it wasn't Jesus' body that's missing, it's someone else. But because he was the only one in the tomb, there was no option to say that. The king's not dead, but alive, and he plans to return and rule and reign over all people of all nations someday. And I want us to read aloud together Revelation 19, 11 to 16. And I want us to think about the fact that we expect the King to return someday. So read it aloud with me. It's going to be on the screen. Then I saw heaven opened, and here came a white horse. The one riding it was called Faithful and True, and with justice he judges and goes to war. His eyes are like a fiery flame, and there are many diadem crowns on his head. He has a name written that no one knows except himself. He is dressed in clothing dipped in blood, and he is called the Word of God. The armies that are in heaven, dressed in white, clean, fine linen, were following him on white horses. From his mouth extends a sharp sword, so that with it he can strike the nations. He will rule them with an iron rod, and he stomps the winepress of the furious wrath of God, the All-Powerful. He has a name written on his clothing and on his thigh, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The hour came, and Jesus was exalted in an odd way for King. He was killed. But the day will come when he comes again. And this time he will be exalted above all, and every eye will see him, and every person will know that he is truly the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. You're probably familiar, at least to some extent, with the legend of King Arthur. As you may remember, there was a sword encased in a stone, and there was a prophecy that said the true king would pull the sword out of the stone. So as we watch this clip from the movie Excalibur, Arthur has been living incognito, and he's now the page for Sir Kay, who is his supposed brother. And they have come to a jousting tournament. And so Kay needs his sword because he's going to joust, he's going to fight these other knights. But someone has stolen Kay's sword. And Arthur takes out, as his page, he takes out in pursuit of the thief because Kay must have a sword for the joust. And that's where we pick up the story.
Your sword was stolen, Kay. But here's Excalibur.
I have drawn a sword.
Kay!
Come
did you free Excalibur from the stone?
Yes.
No,
I didn't.
Arthur did.
The sword! The sword!
You freed it, Arthur?
I did, Father. I beg your forgiveness.
You must put it back.
Draw it again, Arthur.
Wait! I, Urians, will sign! Stand back!
Hey!
No!
The boy! Let the boy try!
Let the boy try!
Let the boy try!
Come on, Arthur! Don't be afraid!
Lies, Father, please. I was your son before I became your king. If I am king.
You are king. The more so because you're not my son. And I am not your father.
Not my father? Then Kay is not my brother?
Merlin the magician brought you to me when you were newly born and bade me raise you as my own. At first I did so because I feared Merlin, but later because I loved you.
Who is my true father?
Only Merlin can tell you that.
And who is Merlin?
I am Merlin.
Whose son am I?
You are the son of Uther and Igraine. You are King Arthur.
Merlin! We haven't forgotten you! What trickery is this?
They're both
He's trying to voice the foundless boy upon us! Do you want a bastard as a king?
Or the undergrounds, join us against the boy!
I saw what I saw! The boy drew the sword. If a boy has been chosen, a boy shall be king!
No! I challenge that!
The sword has been drawn!
Are you with us or against us?
So although Arthur fulfilled the prophecy by pulling the sword from the stone in front of everyone, they saw it. And although Merlin came and testified that by heritage he was the king, many of the knights refused to follow him. They refused to bow the knee to him as king. They said, we will not follow this king. This is not the king that we want. And you note the parallels to Jesus' story. He too lived incognito for 30 years of his life and appeared on the scene and performed many signs and fulfilled the prophecies of the Old Testament. And yet many refused to bow the knee. They refused to accept him as their king. He was not the king that they wanted. Philippians 2, 8 through 11 tells us that the day will come when every knee shall bow before Jesus as the king. Every tongue will confess that he is Lord. And I want to say to you, if you haven't believed in him, if you haven't trusted that he truly is the king, don't wait for that day when we all must bow before him. But believe in him now. Believe that he is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, come to earth, fulfilling the prophecies and dying for you. Recognize that you have rebelled against him and chosen to go your own way instead of bowing the knee before the true King. Ask for his forgiveness based on his death and resurrection for you as his gift. And become part of his kingdom and give your loyalty to him. Perhaps you believe that Jesus is king and have for a long time, but there may be parts of your life that you are still trying to control yourself instead of bowing the knee before the true king. What areas are you unwilling to yield control of? What areas are you trying to keep for yourself? It could be your finances. It could be your possessions. It could be your thought life. The things that you fill your mind with may not be what he wants you to fill your mind with. Maybe it's your time. You don't want to give up your time for what he wants you to do with it. Maybe you don't want to serve where he wants you to serve. Maybe there's someone you haven't forgiven. Or maybe there's someone from whom you need to ask forgiveness. I know in my case, I've got to recommit again to take care of my body and exercise again, because the truth is I don't like it. And so I don't obey and do what God has convicted me to do. He has given me this body. I'm supposed to take care of it, but I don't want to. That's how we take control back. That's how we refuse to bow the knee to him. We just don't want to do what he tells us to do. But I would just encourage you tonight, tomorrow, to really think about what areas of your life do you need to give to him and say, you are king. I bow the knee in this area. Even though it's hard, even though I don't want to do it, I believe in you, and you're a king. And a king rules, and a king reigns. And someday Jesus is going to return. Someday every knee will bow, but we want to bow before him now.